Welcome to Audio Journal's Poets Corner, the program that offers its print-impaired audience and other listeners the opportunity to listen to poetry of people from all walks of life, of those from the distant past right up to the present day. This production is brought to you in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind. I'm Alita Manoogian, and I'd like to share with you the poetry of Robert Frost. Robert Frost, that quintessential New England poet, was actually born in San Francisco in 1874, and his family did not move to New England until Robert was 10 years old, following the death of his father. The move, in a way, was a return, though, for Frost's ancestors were originally New Englanders, and Frost became famous for his poetry's engagement with New England locales, identities, and themes. He would go on to win a record 4 Pulitzer Prizes and become the most famous poet of his time before his death at the age of 88 in 1963. Frost graduated from Lawrence High School in 1892 as class poet and valedictorian. But upon attending Dartmouth, he quickly gave up on that and married his high school sweetheart at the age of 20. He then briefly attended Harvard, but academics were not for him. He decided to be a teacher and a farmer and set up in Derry, New Hampshire. But 11 years later, he confessed himself a failure at that, too, and took his family to England, where his first 2 books of poetry, A Boy's Will and North of Boston, were published to modest success. He returned to the U.S. in 1915 when he was almost 40 and pretty much unknown. But then North of Boston was published in the U.S., followed a year later by A Boy's Will, and suddenly, overnight, he was famous. Unquestionably based on his personal experience, these volumes offered a sometimes tender, sometimes severe poetic realism and contain many of his best-known poems. Here are some of them. The Road Not Taken. 2 roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other, just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet, knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. 2 roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. The Tuft of Flowers. I went to turn the grass once after one who mowed it in the dew before the sun. The dew was gone that made his blade so keen before I came to view the leveled scene. I looked for him behind an aisle of trees. I listened for his whetstone on the breeze. But he had gone his way, the grass all mown, and I must be, as he had been, alone. As all must be, I said within my heart, whether they work together or apart. But as I said it, swift there passed me by, on noiseless wing, a wildered butterfly, seeking with memories grown dim or night some resting flower of yesterday's delight. And once I marked his flight go round and round, as where some flower lay withering on the ground. And then he flew as far as I could see, and then on tremulous wing came back to me. I thought of questions that have no reply, and would have turned to toss the grass to dry, but he turned first, and led my eye to look at a tall tuft of flowers beside a brook. A leaping tongue of bloom the scythe had spared beside a reedy brook the scythe had bared. I left my place to know them by their name, finding them butterfly weed when I came. The mower and the dew had loved them thus by leaving them to flourish, not for us, nor yet to draw one thought of ours to him, but from sheer morning gladness at the brim. The butterfly and I had lit upon, nevertheless, a message from the dawn that made me hear the wakening birds around and hear his long scythe whispering to the ground, and feel a spirit kindred to my own, so that henceforth I worked no more alone, but glad with him I worked as with his aid, and weary sought at noon with him the shade, and dreaming, as it were, held brotherly speech with one whose thought I had not hoped to reach. Men work together, I told him from the heart, whether they work together or apart. Mending Wall. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun, and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I have come after them and made repair where they have left not one stone on stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps I mean, no one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go, to each the boulders that have fallen to each, and some are loaves and some are so near balls we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side. It comes to little more. There where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine, and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here there are no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was likely to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there, bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand, like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only and shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having things, having thought of it so well, he says again, good fences make good neighbors. The Death of the Hired Man. Mary sat musing on the lamp flame at the table, waiting for Warren. When she heard his step, she ran on tiptoe down the darkened passage to meet him in the doorway with the news and put him on his guard. Silas is back. She pushed him outward with her through the door and shut it after. Be kind, she said. She took the market things from Warren's arms and set them on the porch, then drew him down to sit beside her on the wooden steps. When was I anything but kind to him? I'll not have the fellow back, he said. I told him so last haying, didn't I? If he left then, I said, that ended it. What good is he? Who else will harbor him at his age for the little he can do? What help he is, there's no depending on. Off he goes always when I need him most. He thinks he ought to earn a little pay, enough at least to buy tobacco with, so we won't have to beg and be beholden. All right, I say, I can't afford to pay any fixed wages, though I wish I could. Someone else can. Then someone else will have to. I shouldn't mind his bettering himself, if that's what it was. You can be certain, when he begins like that, there's someone at him trying to coax him off with pocket money. In haying time, when help is scarce. In winter, he comes back to us. I'm done. Shh, not so loud, he'll hear you, Mary said. I want him to. He'll have to, soon or late. He's worn out. He's asleep beside the stove. When I came up from Rose, I found him here, huddled against the barn door, fast asleep. A miserable sight and frightening, too. You needn't smile. I didn't recognize him. I wasn't looking for him, and he's changed. Wait till you see.
Where did you say he'd been?
He didn't say. I dragged him to the house and gave him tea and tried to make him smoke. I tried to make him talk about his travels. Nothing would do. He just kept nodding off.
What did he say? Did he say anything?
But little.
Anything? Mary, confess. He said he'd come to ditch the meadow for me.
Warren.
But did he? I just want to know.
Of course he did. What would you have him say? Surely you wouldn't grudge the poor old man some humble way to save his self-respect. He added, if you really care to know, he meant to clear the upper pasture, too.
That sounds like something you heard before.
Warren, I wish you could have heard the way he jumbled everything. I stopped to look two or three times. He made me feel so queer, to see if he was talking in his sleep. He ran on Harold Wilson. You remember the boy you had in haying 4 years since? He's finished school and teaching in his college. Silas declares you'll have to get him back. He says they two will make a team for work. Between them, they will lay this farm as smooth. The way he mixed that in with other things. He thinks young Wilson a likely lad, though daft on education. You know how they fought all through July under the blazing sun, Silas up on the cart to build the load, Harold along beside to pitch it on.
Yes, he took care to keep well out of earshot.
Well, those days trouble Silas like a dream. You wouldn't think they would. How some things linger. Harold's young college boy's assurance piqued him. After so many years, he still keeps finding good arguments he sees he might have used. I sympathize. I know just how it feels to think of the right thing to say too late. Harold's associated in his mind with Latin. He asked me what I thought of Harold saying he studied Latin like the violin because he liked it. That, an argument. He said he couldn't make the boy believe he could find water with a hazel prong, which showed how much good school had ever done him. He wanted to go over that. But most of all, he thinks if he could have another chance to teach him how to build a load of hay.
I know. That's Silas's one accomplishment. He bundles every forkful in its place and tags and numbers it for future reference so he can find it and easily dislodge it in the unloading. Silas does that well. He takes it out in bunches, like big birds' nests. You never see him standing on the hay he's trying to lift, straining to lift himself.
He thinks if he could teach him that, he'd be some good, perhaps, to someone in the world. He hates to see the boy the fool of books. Poor Silas, so concerned for other folk, yet nothing to look backwards to with pride, and nothing to look forward to with hope. So now and never any different. Part of the moon was falling down the west, dragging the whole sky with it to the hills. Its light poured softly in her lap. She saw it and spread her apron to it. She put out her hand among the harp-like morning glory strings, taut with the dew from garden bed to eaves, as if she played unheard some tenderness that wrought on him beside her in the night. "Warren," she said, "he has come home to die. You needn't be afraid he'll leave you this time."
"Home," he mocked gently.
"Yes, where else but home? It all depends on what you mean by home. Of course he's nothing to us, any more than was the hound that came a stranger to us out of the woods, worn upon the trail.
Home is the place where, when you have to go there, they have to take you in."
"I should have called it something you somehow haven't to deserve." Warren leaned out and took a step or two, picked up a little stick and brought it back and broke it in his hand and tossed it by.
"Silas has a better claim on us, you think, than on his brother? 13 miles as the road winds would bring him to his door. Silas has walked that far, no doubt, today. Why didn't he go there? His brother's rich, a somebody, director in the bank."
"He's never told us that."
"We know it, though."
"I think his brother ought to help, of course. I'll see to it if there is need. He ought to have right to take him in and might be willing to.
He may be better than appearances, but have some pity on Silas. Do you think if he'd had any pride in claiming kin or anything he looked for from his brother, he'd keep so still about him all this time? I wonder what's between them. I can tell you. Silas is what he is. We wouldn't mind him, but just the kind that kinfolk can't abide. He never did a thing so very bad. He don't know why he isn't quite as good as anyone. Worthless though he is, he won't be made to shame to please his brother. I can't think Si ever hurt anyone. No, but he hurt my heart, the way he lay rolled his old head on that sharp-edged chair back. He wouldn't let me put him on the lounge. You must go in and see what you can do. I made the bed up for him there tonight. You'd be surprised at him, how much he's broken. His working days are done, I'm sure of it.
I'd not be in a hurry to say that.
I haven't been. Go, look, see for yourself. But, Warren, please remember how it is. He's come to help you ditch the meadow. He has a plan. You mustn't laugh at him. He may not speak of it, and then he may. I'll sit and see if that small sailing cloud will hit or miss the moon. It hit the moon. And then there were three there, making a dim row. The moon, the little silver cloud, and she. Warren returned. Too soon, it seemed to her, slipped to her side, caught up her hand, and waited. Warren? She questioned. Dead, was all he answered. Several new qualities emerged in Frost's work with the appearance of New Hampshire in 1923, for which he won his first Pulitzer Prize, and A Further Range, 1936, which earned him another one. He seemed newly self-aware and willing to speak of himself in his art. He won his fourth and final Pulitzer in 1943. Here are some poems from several of his final volumes. Birches. When I see birches bend to left and right across the line of straighter, darker trees, I like to think some boy's been swinging them. But swinging them doesn't bend them down to stay as ice storms do. Often you must have seen them loaded with ice on a sunny winter morning after a rain. They click upon themselves as the breeze rises and turn many-colored as the stir cracks and crazes their enamel. Soon the sun's warmth makes them shed crystal shells, shattering and avalanching on the snow crust. Such heaps of broken glass to sweep away, you'd think the inner dome of heaven had fallen. They are dragged to the withered bracken by the load, and they seem not to break. Though once they are bowed so low for long, they never right themselves. You may see their trunks arching in the woods years afterwards, trailing their leaves on the ground like girls on hands and knees that throw their hair before them over their heads to dry in the sun. But I was going to say, when Truth broke in with all her matter-of-fact about the ice storm, I should prefer to have some boy bend them as he went out and in to fetch the cows. Some boy too far from town to learn baseball, whose only play was what he found himself. Summer and winter, and could play alone. One by one, he subdued his father's trees by riding them down over and over again until he took the stiffness out of them. And not one but hung limp, not one was left for him to conquer. He learned all there was to learn about not launching out too soon, and so not carrying the tree away clear to the ground. He always kept his poise to the top branches, climbing carefully with the same pains you use to fill a cup up to the brim and even above the brim. Then he flung outward, feet first, with a swish, kicking his way down through the air to the ground. So was I once myself, a swinger of birches, and so I dream of going back to be. It's when I'm weary of considerations, and life is too much like a pathless wood where your face burns and tickles with cobwebs broken across it, and one eye is weeping from a twig's having lashed across it open. I'd like to get away from Earth a while and then come back to it and begin over. May no fate willfully misunderstand me and half grant what I wish and snatch me away not to return. Earth the right place for love. I don't know where it's likely to go better. I'd like to go by climbing a birch tree and climb black branches up a snow-white trunk toward heaven till the tree could bear no more but dipped its top and set me down again. That would be good both going and coming back. One could do worse than be a swinger of birches. Fire and ice. Some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. But if it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great. In 1963, President John F. Kennedy delivered a speech at the dedication of the Robert Frost Library in Amherst, Massachusetts. In honoring Robert Frost, said the president, we therefore can pay honor to the deepest source of our national strength. That strength takes many forms, and the most obvious forms are not always the most significant. Our national strength matters, but the spirit which informs and controls our strength matters just as much. This was the special significance of Robert Frost. The poet would have probably been pleased by such recognition, for he had said once in an interview with Harry Bright, "One thing I care about and wish young people could care about is taking poetry as the first form of understanding. If poetry isn't understanding at all, the whole world then isn't worth it." When asked to write and then read a poem for John F. Kennedy's inauguration in 1961, Frost, who was 86 at the time, lost his paper and lost his place in the cold wind that day. Instead, he recited this poem, which he had written for his 1943 volume, Witness True. The Gift Outright. The land was ours before we were the land's. She was our land more than 100 years before we were her people. She was ours in Massachusetts, in Virginia. But we were England's, still colonials, possessing what we were unpossessed by what we now no more possessed. Something we were withholding made us weak until we found out that it was ourselves we were withholding from our land of living, and forthwith found salvation in surrender. Such as we were, we gave ourselves outright. The deed of gift was many deeds of war. To the land vaguely realizing westward, but still unstoried, artless, unenhanced, such as she was, such as she would become. Two tramps in mud time. Out of the mud, two strangers came and caught me splitting wood in the yard. And one of them put me off my aim by hailing cheerily, "Hit 'em hard!" I knew pretty well why he dropped behind and let the other go on away. I knew pretty well what he had in mind. He wanted to take my job for pay. Good blocks of beech it was I split, as large around as the chopping block, and every piece I squarely hit fell splinterless as a cloven rock. The blow that a life of self-control spares to strike for the common good that day, giving loose to my soul, I spent on unimportant wood. The sun was warm, but the wind was chill. You know how it is with an April day. When the sun is out and the wind is still, you're 1 month on in the middle of May. But if you so much as dare to speak, a cloud comes over the sunlit arch, a wind comes off a frozen peak, and you're 2 months back in the middle of March. A bluebird comes tenderly up to alight and fronts the wind to unruffle a plume, his song so pitched as not to excite a single flower as yet to bloom. It is snowing a flake, and he half knew winter was only playing possum. Except in color, he isn't blue. But he wouldn't advise a thing to blossom. The water for which we may have to look in summertime with the witching wand, in every wheel rut's now a brook, in every print of a hoof a pond. Be glad of water, but don't forget the lurking frost in the earth beneath that will steal forth after the sun is set and show the water its crystal teeth. The time when I most loved my task, these two must make me love it more by coming with what they came to ask. You'd think I had never felt before the weight of an axe head poised aloft, the grip on earth of outspread feet, the life of muscles rocking soft and smooth and moist in the vernal heat. Out of the woods, two hulking tramps, from sleeping God knows where last night, but not long since in the lumber camps, they thought all chopping was theirs of right. Men of the woods and lumberjacks, they judged me by their appropriate tool, except as a fellow handled an axe, they had no way of knowing a fool. Nothing on either side was said. They knew they had but to stay their stay, and all their logic would fill my head, as that I had no right to play with what was another man's work for gain. My right might be love, but theirs was need, and where the two exist in twain, theirs was the better right. Agreed. But yield who will to their separation, my object in living is to unite my avocation and my vocation as my two eyes make one in sight. Only where love and need are one and the work is play for mortal stakes is the deed ever really done for heaven and the future's sakes. Come in. As I came to the edge of the woods, thrush music, hark! And now, if it was dusk outside, inside it was dark. Too dark in the woods for a bird by sleight of wing to better its perch for the night, though it still could sing. The last of the light of the sun that had died in the west still lived for one song more in a thrush's breast. Far in the pillared dark, thrush music went, almost like a call to come into the dark and lament. But no, I was out for stars. I would not come in. I meant not even if asked, and I hadn't been. I'll end with Frost's best known and what many think is his most perfect poem, Stopping by Woods in a Snowy Evening, from 1923. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep and miles to go before I sleep. You've been listening to Poet's Corner, a production of Audio Journal, proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you have any comments or suggestions for Poets Corner, please let us know by calling us at 508-797-1117 or by emailing us at info@audiojournal.org or by mailing us at Audio Journal, 799 West Boylston Street, Worcester, Massachusetts, 01606. This program has been archived on our website, audiojournal.org, along with other Audio Journal programs. I'm Alida Manoogian. Thank you for listening.